This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 41 of What's It Like. My guest is Richard McManus, who is a TAG Teach expert and director of the Fluency Factory, a fee-based learning center that retrains children to do well in school. Hey, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good. You're in the Boston area.
Yes, Hingham, Massachusetts.
Did you grow up there?
No, I didn't. I grew up in Western Pennsylvania.
Did you come from a large family?
I did. I'm the oldest of seven.
Oh, that's quite a group. So how was childhood for you?
It was fun. I was fortunate having that big family and living in a very kid-friendly kind of area first when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of it, I was running. Things got a little tougher in teenage years.
Yeah.
My father died very young.
Ah, that can be hard.
Mm.
So who was the largest influence on your life?
Professionally, and I guess in a lot of ways, Eric Cotton, who is a behavioral person. He was one of the first people to do a lot of work with free operant approach with people and was involved in the first token economy and then went and studied with Og Lindsley at Harvard and was, to me, kind of a co-founder of precision teaching, which is what I do.
What was your major challenge as a child?
I wasn't good at sports. So in Western Pennsylvania, for quite a while, that wasn't so good. I grew, and when I grew, I got better. But when I was little, a big challenge was, as a boy, being like not a good football player or basketball player or baseball player.
So how did you get from the fields of Pennsylvania to the schools outside of Boston? That seems like quite a trek.
It was quite a trek. I went to Kenyon College as an undergraduate, and I studied in philosophy, which, because my plan was to be a rock and roll star, didn't matter too much what I studied in. When I graduated, the other thing I really liked was water, salt water, so I moved to Annapolis, Maryland for a while, and then had a friend who really wanted me to move to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I moved up to Cambridge, and while I was in Cambridge, because I was still on my way to becoming a rock and roll star, I needed a day job. So a fellow that I knew who's a jazz player said, well, you could come and work at Fernald State School, which is a big institution. It's pretty ugly, but they'll always have jobs, so you can get a job there. So I did. I went out there and started working and wound up doing direct care with people with serious handicaps. And expecting not to like it very much, or to be mostly not like the people very much, or at least not be able to relate to them, but found them, the whole situation, kind of amazing. Terrible, but, you know, amazing. So I kind of got hooked on trying to reform the way folks with disabilities got treated. And over time, I kept getting different jobs within that setting and eventually wound up in the psychology department, and I was in a master's program for applied behavior analysis there. It was a program that had just been started by Northeastern University, and the woman who started it had come from Kansas and had her doctorate in applied behavior analysis. So when she set up her program, she replicated the Kansas doctoral program, not quite thinking that it's only a master's. So 2 years in, we'd done all of our coursework, but they hadn't defined what the rest of the projects were going to be.
Hmm.
4 years in, my ex-wife was the first graduate. 2 more years and another person graduated. So the first few years of that program just were not good at churning out anybody with degrees.
Can you give a thumbnail of what precision teaching is?
I can. Did you ever see the first Karate Kid movie?
Yes.
Okay. So precision teaching, first of all, is just a measurement system. It's a way to take any kind of a movement that a person makes and put it on a graphic display. And the original idea was there needed to be a common language about behavior and a way to display it so that people didn't spend a lot of their time going, well, on the x-axis I have minutes between outbursts. And on the y-axis, I have the severity of the outburst. And on and on. There are just a million ways that people would try to show behavior on a piece of paper. And it's everyone spent more time trying to figure out what that piece of paper said than what the behavior was. It wasn't a standard way to look at behavior. So Og Lindsley decided that what we needed was a single chart that could record anything that a human being could do, from one something in a day in 24 hours to a million somethings in 24 hours. So the only thing that would do that was semi-logarithmic graph paper. So he and Eric developed a bunch of different pieces of graph paper, tried them all out, and over the course of about a year and a half in 67, 68, came up with what they called then the standard behavior chart, which was a chart that could literally show anything between one time in a day to a million times in a day. Turns out there's not much human beings can do a million times in a day. You can read silently at 1,000 a minute, but this chart goes from once in a minute to 1,000 in a minute of whatever it is. So pretty early on, they discovered that if you were really, really good at something, like, say, reading, you were probably doing it at a high frequency. You could tell the difference by listening to a good reader versus a not-so-good reader, where they might both read 100% correct. The good reader could read 200 to 240 words a minute aloud. Mediocre to poor reader would be somewhere below that, sometimes far below that. And they started to look at learning in terms of frequencies. And that's where this, going back to the Karate Kid, the approach that's developed out of precision teaching, which is somewhat curriculum-based, is that component skills like a hand movement or a single stroke with a pencil are critical ingredients to being really good at whatever the composite skill is. So it's like that wax on, wax off.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the precision teaching programs will feature some part of, let's make sure that whatever skill you're working on, those components are polished, high frequency, easy for you to do. And we'll start there. And as the kid gets or adult gets more skilled, then we'll bring in more, we'll have those components start to compound together and make bigger pieces. So the components are kind of like elements, mm-hmm. and the bigger pieces, the compounds, are kind of like molecules of different things. So, for example, we teach reading using phonemic awareness and sounds, and we make sure kids can read sounds at a high frequency. And also simple words at a high frequency, and then sentences and stories. And we build it up piece by piece. And we use these charts to guide us, to let us know if the kid is increasing in skill, or if he or she is not, then we know it's time to do something different. So if we see a flat line, it's like, oh my God, this kid is not really getting good enough at these components to be able to do the more difficult pieces. So that's as close as I can get to a simple explanation.
How do you teach something like silent reading, which is a behavior but difficult to observe?
Well, we start off with all observable, right? We start with reading aloud. One good thing about precision teaching, unlike more standard kind of classical behavior analysis, is we're big believers in behavior we can't see. So somebody says they just counted to 100 in their head, we're willing to say, okay, good, now count to 500. Or if you're going to read silently, go ahead. We'll let the kid measure himself even reading silently. Hit this button when you start, hit the other button when you stop, and we'll put in how many words, and we'll know how many words in a minute. But we don't do much silent reading until the student is really fluent at reading aloud. In fact, that's one of the biggest problems if you look at how reading's taught in the schools. There's huge amounts of silent reading. In our part of the world, it's called SSR, sustained silent reading. And in other places, it's called, drop everything and read. So whatever that acronym is here, drop everything and read. There's a bunch of different sustained silent reading. And the National Reading Panel back in the year 2000 said, there's no evidence any of this is good for reading. And unfortunately, it means a lot of kids are just sitting there staring at books and actually doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there research that shows that reading aloud in a group, if everyone is following along, is not terribly helpful for the people who are following, but helpful for the person who is reading?
I'm afraid that's true, too. Yeah. That's why I think the way that reading was taught back when I was a kid, which was primitive, I had nuns beating us senseless if we failed to learn, was probably better than what we're doing now in our schools, because now most of the schools in this country are using whole language. So kids, the expectation is that reading is a natural act like learning to talk. If you're in a household where people talk, you're going to learn to talk if you're a human being. And the belief is similar about reading. The core philosophy of whole language is kids are natural readers. If you give them good, what's called authentic text to read, they'll love it and learn to read naturally.
So it's a problem of motivation.
Well, if you don't learn to read, then you have a reading disability.
Yes, which is not defined as a lack of motivation.
No, no. In that case, it's something wrong with the kid.
That's right.
My argument about that has often been, I've had run into the teachers that believe that. And I'm like, so if a kid doesn't learn to play a saxophone, he has a saxophone disability. In most cases, to learn to play a saxophone or an instrument of any kind, you need lessons. And if you don't give lessons that start with scales and start with even single fingerings and stuff like that, kid's not going to learn it.
Right.
Same thing true with reading.
Right. Which is why it's important for parents to read with their children, to sit down with them and essentially teach them how to read.
Absolutely. But some kids need explicit phonics. The research says about 40% of our kids need explicit phonics instruction to become good readers. And by good readers, I mean that they're reading at their age or grade level, not several years below. I mean, our national reading level is about sixth grade. We are not highly ranked in the world in terms of our reading skills. And probably we're falling because we're not serving our new populations well, our multilingual populations well. So it's a big concern of mine. And, you know, it's been part of what we've done with what we're doing here, trying to get the best kind of reading instruction. That was really our beginning point.
I want to find out what a typical day is like for Richard, but while he thinks about that, let me thank you for your generosity. This has been a fun project, and every step along the way, people have been helpful and big-hearted. They've given their time to be interviewed. They have contributed money. And if you'd like to donate to the cause, click on the donate button at whatsitlike.info. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
So, Richard, did you always want to be an educator?
I would have to say probably not. No, no. It wasn't what I set out to do at all. For a time when I was doing applied behavior analysis, I was primarily working with people with violent behavior. But even then, one of the things that I realized was that with good instruction and lots of positive reinforcement, you wound up with a person who was exceedingly well-behaved and interested in the world. So I started out, my first assignment as a psychologist was a ward called the Combat Zone at the big state institution. And it was called the Combat Zone because the men, it was all men when I first started, were blind and blind deaf men from all over Massachusetts who were sent to this one place because of their violent and or self-destructive behavior. So pretty exciting place to work. There's a big group of men and women with retrolental fibroplasia was developed in the period from 1945 to 1955. Premature babies were given lots and lots of oxygen to keep them alive.
Yes.
Turned out that giving that much oxygen tended to lead to blindness.
Yeah, bad for the eyes.
Bad for the eyes. And some of these folks were very like our autistic kids, which we now have lots of those. For whatever reason, and I think some of it was being premature, some of it was the blindness. There are a whole lot of potential reasons, but there was a big generation of folks with RLF and some chunk of that group had some violent and difficult behaviors as well. So I had my little group and they were wonderful to learn from because I learned how to shape behavior, how to think about people whose input channels were very limited. They couldn't see, some cases they couldn't hear. And we wanted to teach them communication skills, simple life skills like eating, feeding themselves, because they'd been in an institution where if they didn't eat nicely, they'd be put up against the wall and made to eat in kind of rapid and ugly fashion. So it was a great learning experience for me. And at some point, I decided that what I really was interested in was better instruction in general. And I was hired to run one of the early programs for autistic children. And I brought my skills to that. And that was a great opportunity. That's how I met Eric Cotton. And I had already known some of these folks from the Eunice Kennedy Shriver Center, from Northeastern University. So I took the skills that I learned from all those folks, and we did a lot of really interesting programming that's now being used again in programs all over the country for autistic children and young adults, I suppose. But it kind of vanished for a little while, vanished from the school that I was doing it at. And I got a bit discouraged about nonprofits. Most of us folks in precision teaching found the politics got to be overwhelming. Doing precision teaching takes doing charting, and a lot of people don't feel like they want to do it. After a little while, you don't have any feedback on whether or not a child is learning. And after a little while, you're really not doing precision teaching. You're doing something else.
I believe it's called imprecise teaching.
Yeah, that's it. That's right. That's right. You don't really know whether you're making any difference.
No.
For a while, I was hired. I started a consulting business to deal with people with behavior problems, with the hope that what we do was, because by then I already felt pretty strongly that there's very little, I guess like Karen Pryor, there's very little you can do with negative consequences that's going to lead to anything better. What you'll wind up with often is an angrier and more withdrawn individual. You don't get a person who's more willing to participate in learning or participate in work.
Yes.
So I started a company called Tools for Change, and we did behavior change projects of all kinds. And because of my background by then, a lot of the work we did early on was with very violent folks. But the bad news about doing that work was there are lots of people that want to pay for that, and still are, that want to pay for reducing problem behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people who want to think about or try to do things that will teach them how to teach better. They just want that behavior to go away, please. And that's all we want. We want to just come in here and stop this thing from happening. So,
and yet one of the ways to change negative behaviors is to replace it with a positive behavior.
That's what we would tell them. But for whatever reason, that wasn't as much fun as just getting rid of the negative. That other stuff sounds like too much work.
Yes.
So I got hired by one of my clients to run a big rehabilitation center. I had about 600, probably more than that, but around 600 clients in a variety of different kind of vocational settings, everything from beginning pre-vocational skills all the way up to folks who are learning competitive level employment skills to get out. And that was a great experience. I spent 8 years doing that. But at the end of it, I was running an affirmative industry where we made products, medical products that were sold at first to the government, and later now that company's still going, sells all privately to medical distributors. It was one of the early affirmative industries.
Oh.
And it was fun to do at first. Over time, what happened was we got really good. All of our people got really good at their jobs. Our purchasing systems got better. Our sales systems got better. And at some point at a cocktail party, a woman said to me, "So you make medical waste?" And I thought about it and I said, "Yeah, that's what we do now. I thought I was a people development person, but now the company's so darn good. Mostly I'm doing sales and advertising and, you know, dealing with purchasing issues. I'm no longer doing people development, which is really my strength area."
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up looking for something else, and I did consulting work for about the next 7 years in big corporations and developed training programs for executives and managers and delivered some and And that was fun, but it was, I felt like the big thing to me, what the thing I'm best at is this, what we're doing now with teaching children and really giving, starting, it's much easier to teach a child than an adult, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. And now you're director of the Fluency Factory. What a great job.
It's a great job. It's the best job I ever had. I've done it more than I've done any other job now, too, in 9 years.
So what exactly do you do?
Well, we run a center that teaches kids of all ages. Our youngest child right now is a six-year-old. Our oldest right now is 21. And we teach a very wide spectrum of skills and a very wide spectrum of kids. And our 21-year-old is about to leave. He's just doing a little fill-in time. We started off primarily teaching reading using the precision teaching approach that Michael Maloney had developed up in Canada. And we have continued to add on to his work and the other curriculums that are out there. Now we're, I think, close to the most effective reading program in the country, if not the most effective.
Hmm.
Mostly because we've been fortunate. We happened to be standing in the right direction when a woman named Jean Tucker developed a really new reading program this past year. It's been a magical program.
So what's the best thing about your job?
The best thing is seeing kids develop. That's the part that I like.
Mm-hmm.
I got hooked on this when I had my own daughter having reading issues as a first grader, and was able to use some of the programs we still use now with her. And she had stomach aches 5 days a week and was really very, very worried. And I said to her, "You don't have any stomach aches on Saturday or Sunday." So I'm thinking, and she's in first grade, and you know, 5 days a week she would wake up with a stomach ache. And I said, "I think it's the reading. Maybe if you and I work together on that, I can help you some. I know a really good book we could get." And she said, "Dad, let's get in the car right now and go get that book." It really turned out to be, for me at least, it was an incredible experience to see her stomach aches go away and her skills develop. And still today, I mean, like, I just saw a little girl who's a sixth, going into seventh grade, in terrible pain and worry about herself. And we've had no shortage of kids. We've had kids who are remarkably gifted in some areas who are struggling in others, and just seeing what happens to them, mm-hmm. how worried they become, how their whole self gets damaged by some skill area that's not strong and their worry about that. You know, it's just been a wonderful thing to be able to see kids literally transformed in a fairly short amount of time from terribly worried to, "Oh, I can do better at this. This is going to work for me." We had one little boy who, when he was three, was first in a program for violent kids and has been in programs for violent kids ever since. And he's a fifth grader now. And he'd never really learned to read. We got him this past January. He's just taken off. I mean, it's just stunning to watch his work. He said to his mom as he was driving, his mom came in and she said, "I can't believe it." She said, "We're driving up the driveway." And he says to me, "I just love this place." And then he said to his mom, "Can I come three times a week instead of two?" And of course, she was so excited that he was learning. And my goal for him this summer is I want him to walk into sixth grade at a sixth grade level. And this is from not really at a first grade level in January.
Wow.
So that level of change for a kid is just, to me, that's what makes it fun to wake up every day.
Yeah.
And a lot of what I'm doing now is trying to figure out why we're not more popular. I mean, we were growing fairly quickly, but there's a part of me that goes, why would anyone send a kid to anyone else? We can do things in a short amount of time that are like so amazing. So we're trying to figure out how we get that message out more clearly to people.
Do you remember what the book was that you bought for your daughter?
Absolutely. It was Zig Engelman wrote a book called Teach Your Child to Read in 100 Easy Lessons. And it's a direct instruction book. So it's a behavioral kind of a book. Zig Engelman is up in Oregon, and he has developed programs for pretty much every area of academic pursuit called direct instruction programs. They're published by SRA, except for 100 Easy Lessons, which is a more pop kind of book. And the man is an amazing genius of curriculum design and making it easy for me as a parent at the time and for my daughter as a learner to become a reader.
What's the worst thing about your job?
The worst thing. That's a good question. I guess because I'm so motivated by seeing kids progress, the worst thing is when, for whatever reason, I can't, we're not effective. And often it's my own fault because I've violated a principle that I have, like I pretty much now won't take children unless they come at least 2 hours a week. And I've been told by some of my colleagues I should never take anyone less than 4 days a week for a minimum of an hour. And they're probably right. Mm-hmm. Because I've seen what happened. I mean, when we're not effective, it's most often because of that. The other thing that was really frustrating to me was sometimes we don't have the right tool. Still today, we had a little group of mystery children who were remarkably gifted readers to just hear them read, could read material out loud at 200 words a minute, could read at grade level, but whose reading comprehension would be 10th or 20th percentile or below. And it was a mystery to me. And we just, thanks to Gene Tucker, we now have that mystery solved. But we had one kid in particular whose parents invested a lot of time and money in her work here. And we did not help her very much.
They just couldn't translate it in their heads?
That's the clearest way to put it, I think. They couldn't translate it in their heads. And it turns out the reason that they couldn't translate it in their heads was they had never learned to hear vowel sounds in isolation. Like, all vowel sounds sound the same to these kids. They all sound like, And in fact, my daughter, who I taught when she was a six-year-old, is now 25-year-old, has a doctorate in physical therapy, was advanced placed in all math and sciences. To this day, she cannot hear those vowel sounds. So I keep saying to her, Caitlin, should get you to come in and spend a few hours. I can teach them to you now. But 5 years ago, I couldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. But the weird thing is that would have that level of impact on reading comprehension. In my daughter's case, it does not. I mean, her reading comprehension is good, but she doesn't enjoy reading. She does it if it's work. She likes it and loves it because she loves to work. But for pleasure, that's just not something that she will ever do.
Mm-hmm. What type of person would be good at your job?
I think about that a lot. I guess I'm in a somewhat different spot, but I'm going to take my teachers as examples. Because there are people like the characteristic that I share with them is that we get excited about seeing kids develop. And it's a major reinforcement for us. It's something that, you know, we love to see. And conversely, if they're not learning, we get worried about it and try different things. And that's, I think, what people here like to chart. And I think it's mostly because of that. They can see right away if they're getting results or if they're not. And the times that people don't like to chart in general are the times that it says, this isn't working.
So it's a combination of being creative and practical.
I think so. And being, I mean, I've made some mistakes in hiring. Who hasn't? And the mistakes stand out to me as there's some people motivated, just want to be bossy with children, and that's why they like to teach. And there, I had one student once, when I was first open, I had me and some computers in a storefront kind of location, and I had no other tutors. And one of my earliest kids, I said, we're getting bigger now. I can't handle everybody, so I'm going to have to hire another tutor. What do you think? Who should I hire? And he said, I don't know who you should hire, but I can tell you who not to hire. Those bad-smelling old ladies, they're mean kids. And he was right. There's some teachers whose thrill in life is to be demanding and nasty to kids. So I avoid those.
Kids are smarter than you think, huh?
Oh, yeah. They're very good at sniffing out the people. And it doesn't have to be older people. I hired a young woman who was going to just help us around. In the summer, we sometimes hire a college kid or two to help us, you know, manage everything and set our teachers up and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I hired a young woman who had been doing the drama camp here in Hingham for some years. And my wife thought she was fabulous because she would see her at this recreation camp drop off and pick up. And all the parents thought she was fabulous. But as soon as the kids heard I was hiring, I had four kids come to me and say, "You don't want to hire her. She is mean. Don't have her around me." And I'd keep her away from other kids.
Drama people are like that sometimes.
They are sometimes. So I had to give this young woman the feedback, and she wasn't going to teach for us anyway. And I've never been certain she understood the feedback or really got it, but
yeah.
I've always been kind of curious. I think that's real true. I think what you said about drama people is true. And then there's folks, and this is the other mistake I've sometimes made. There are people who just love to be around kids, but they don't care about development one way or the other. They just like to be around kids. So, you know, babysitting is good for them, but teaching is not something that's a real passion.
Yeah. What's a typical day like for you?
Typical day, I do some scheduling of the students that we have. Now I'm doing more and more writing.
You see students yourself?
I do, but not in as many numbers as I used to. I've cut back. My brother has been my consultant for business, and he's been adamant that he said, you know, you have people who can tutor, but you don't have other people who can go out and get more kids for you to tutor. So if you don't do that, nobody else is going to do that. So you have to do that part. And he's been great for me that way. We were this past year running a school for kids with disabilities as well as running our tutoring program. And we spent 2 years getting it approved by the state. And then this past May, I wrote and unapproved it after it had been approved for 2 years. Wasn't growing. The political situation here in Massachusetts right now, it's just very difficult to get students through that process.
Right.
Parents have to sue practically. There's no money in the cities and towns to easily help these children that need learning help. And most likely, although I can handle that kind of work, the kids that are getting referred out, as one superintendent said to me, are the fire starters and sexual offenders. And she said, "I can give you all of those you want." And really what we're set up to do is to really reach kids with learning disabilities and rapidly get them to a point where they don't need any assistance anymore.
Yeah.
So we're going to try to go back to what we initially did as a school, and that was let parents tuition their child in, and if nobody wants to do that, we won't have a school. But I think there'll be a fair number of folks who want to do that and that we will find. But up till this year, for the last 5 years, a big chunk of my time has been either teaching or supervising the instruction of our school, as well as doing an after-school program. So it was a long day.
We'll have more with Richard McManus right after I remind you about the importance of health. Let me take a moment to introduce you to a disorder that impacts a lot of people. In the UK, it's called ME, myalgic encephalopathy. In the U.S., it's called CFIDS, Chronic Fatigue and Immune Dysfunction Syndrome. Whatever you call it, it's a chronic neurological disease of unknown cause and no known cure. Most every body system is impacted, including the musculoskeletal, immune, and central nervous systems. Symptoms include problems with vision, balance, coordination, pain, and sensitivity to cold, sound, and visceral stimulation. It screws up mitochondrial production and cellular metabolism and replication. For many, it's a totally disabling condition, and even for those patients who get better, it's a relapsing, remitting disease. Although it can occur at any age, it's mostly found in women in their 20s and 30s. My daughter has been sick with this condition since her junior year in college. This is a disorder that really needs more research, so go to cfids.org and donate, cfids.org. Thanks. So, Richard, everyone has to give themselves self-motivation. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Well, I use the charts to look at. I mean, one thing I learned when I was doing the manufacturing company and doing the other kinds of work I've done over the years these charts really can measure just about anything a human being can do, or even a group of humans can do. So we use it to look at our numbers of sessions taught. We look at it to look at a lot of different things. If I use them, they kick me in the pants a lot of times. It's like, we're not growing enough, or I really think we could do this a lot better. We've got to, the growth part has been the big kick in the pants part for me. I feel like we should be driving other tutoring centers all around us out of business. And the fact that we're not doing that is very upsetting to me. So that's one of my major kicks in the pants. Mm-hmm. The other one was some of the times when we'd have kids that we would look at the charts, and the teachers that I'm using are just wonderful teachers. And I think, obviously, we don't know enough yet. There's still things we need to learn. Early on, when I first met Eric Cotton, he's the other person who taught me some great ways to kick yourself. I was running a school for people with severe behavior disorders, autism, and everything else. And we were looking at reading data, and kids obviously were not learning it. And one of my teachers said, well, these are severely retarded autistic people. What do you expect? We're getting paid more money than Harvard. I expect they'll learn to read. That's what we're setting out to do here. So one of the things I learned back then was you got to keep your expectations very high and clear. And that was another thing that Eric helped me with. Commonplace with the other places that I've worked, that if your expectations are high, people will meet them. Or if they miss by a little bit, they'll still have usable skill. But once you think to yourself, well, you're not going to get that good at this anyway, pretty much automatically you've made it so that your students are not likely to be successful, or your teachers, your employees, your managers you're trying to develop, or your executives you're trying to develop, whatever work you're doing, you've got to keep those expectations very high and not allow the blame to get shifted off of yourself in when you're an agent for change. You have to think, all right, this isn't happening, so what am I doing wrong? Rather than, well, obviously this kid doesn't learn things because he doesn't learn things. Mm-hmm. That's the mistake I see with the schools. Here's a kid with reading disabilities. He's not reading. Obviously, it's because he has reading disabilities. What more is there to say?
When you have to calm yourself down, how do you soothe yourself?
I take a long walk every morning with my dog. I take a long walk every morning with my dog in the woods. I have a pretty large German Shepherd cross sort of dog, and we take a long walk and I think about things. And I also sail. I love to sail. So I'll go out, and if I can't sail during the winter, I'll look at video or drool over sailboats that I can't afford. But sailing and dog walking are my two big ways to calm myself down.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Oh, many. Probably most dramatically being a divorced person. That was the hardest thing for me.
Is there an idea or a principle that has helped you through those challenges?
Yeah, I guess it kind of goes back to the other things that, you know, there's a way through. You have to work and find it. I guess at the core that even an old person such as myself can always learn new things.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say? What would be your best advice?
One of my tutors who left here, and I was brokenhearted because I think she's a wonderful young teacher, put it up on our, gave me this gift at Christmas one time. And it was, I guess, her parting gift to me. She really liked being here. And I thought she was at the beginning of an incredible career, but it was a quote from Winston Churchill. And it just says, never, 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 never give up.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about tag teaching.
Well, I've used tag teaching for years before it was even called tag teaching. So I got into clicker training many, many years ago. I didn't know Karen at the time. It was part of a training program that I put together that we still use with our teachers. We spend 20 to 40 hours or so with everyone who works here, teaching them through a tag teaching kind of method how to be good at observing behavior, paying attention to good behavior. And it's all live and it's all immediate, and they have to role play stuff that's also live. I'll role play a violent person or a very difficult person, and we don't really serve at this point any very violent people, but it's helpful for people to feel like there's a little bit of risk in these games. But they're teaching games, but they're based on tag teach.
So what do you do with a violent person? Do you throw him a candy?
You discover by watching their behavior what is moment-to-moment kind of has the ability to shape behavior. Quite often with violent people, they've been shaped up. We have one kid that just started recently who's been shaped up this way. They've been shaped up by seeing fearful responses or flinching or angry looks. And those things tend to be like throwing gasoline on a fire. So mm-hmm. A lot of times, even back when I was working with lots of dangerous folks, one of the key things was just learning to keep a poker face and to get control of your own emotional expression so that you could stay calm, use a smile, or sometimes with folks with really serious disabilities and really serious violent behavior, sometimes using really strong expressions of any sort would be a powerful reinforcer. So we'd only use them for good performances. So if the person was looking, had their hands down or was doing work, we might respond with a really firm handshake or even grab their hand to do a pump like a politician's handshake. Those kinds of interactions for positive behavior were often really successful, where sometimes these folks had been taught by, and it's a sad state, but you're required in Massachusetts to train your staff if you're going to run an approved school in restraint techniques. Restraint techniques for violent people are like throwing gasoline on a fire, I think. And quite often, restraint is one of the few ways they get a lot of physical interaction. And us humans love that stuff. So, mm-hmm. You know, if what it takes to get, you know, a good-looking young teacher to interact with me physically is punching at her, well, hey, it's the cost of doing business. I'll punch at her and she'll restrain me. It's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a win-win.
Huh? It's a win-win, exactly.
I think we often think of behavior as being continuous, but it comes in spurts.
Exactly.
Which does give you an opportunity then to respond to it and to reinforce either changes or lack of behavior.
Yes. And we try to target behavior rather than lack of, because one of the things that I've learned over the years is it's pretty much always true that if you're passing out some kind of reinforcer, whether it's M&Ms or we use something called widgets that is this fake money that kids can use to buy anything from Amazon and iTunes gift cards to little novelty items and candy bars. Whatever you're using is going to change behavior and increase something.
Yes.
You want that something to be something good. You don't want it yes. to be, well, I've been able to increase behavior. Unfortunately, the behavior I've increased is strangling me.
The rewards tend to make behaviors go up.
Yes. So
all behaviors.
Yes. So you've got to have targeted some behaviors to make sure that the behaviors you're increasing are the ones that will do everybody some more good. Mm-hmm. Rather than increasing some behavior that lead to trouble.
I want to thank Richard McManus for joining me today. Thanks, Richard. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure.